KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, November 20th, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Today's topic will be the Omaha Public Schools versus the State of Nebraska. The speakers will be Stephen Wilborn, the Dean of the University of Nebraska College of Law, and John Langan, the President of the Omaha Public Schools Board of Education. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Hugh Cowden.
Good afternoon. My name is Hugh Cowden. I'm a member of the Education Committee of the Omaha Press Club. At least once a month, the Press Club sponsors a forum that we think will be of interest to our members and to the community at large. You do not have to be a Press Club member to attend. The forums are open to everyone. Last June, the Omaha Public School District, along with the Grand Island and South Sioux City School Districts, filed a lawsuit against the state of Nebraska in a case that the Dean of the University of Nebraska College of Law has called, quote, one of a handful of the most important cases in the state's history, and he has distributed a handout at your table in which he now calls it the most important case in the state's history. The suit calls for the courts to declare the system for distributing state aid to Nebraska school districts unconstitutional. The state officials who are being sued include the governor, the state education commissioner, and members of the state board of education. The two panelists who are here today to discuss this are Professor Stephen L. Wilborn, who is the aforementioned Dean of the University of Nebraska College of Law, and Dr. John T. Langan, President of the Omaha School Board. Dean Wilborn has been on the UNL Law faculty since 1979. He is the Schmoker Professor of Law there and has been Dean of the College since 2001. Last July, he co-authored two op-ed articles in the Omaha World Herald opposing the lawsuit, arguing that the suit is based on a, quote, weak legal foundation. Dr. Langan has been a member of the OPS board for 14 years and president of the board for the past 6 years. He is currently acting dean of the College of Education at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and has been on the faculty there for 34 years, including 12 as chairman of the Teacher Education Department. The OPS board voted unanimously to authorize the lawsuit against the state. On the other hand, the Lincoln School Board voted unanimously to intervene in opposition to the suit. In addition to Dean Wilborn's two co-authored pieces in opposition, the Omaha World Herald has published several other op-ed pieces, both pro and con, including one from a former Chief Justice of the Nebraska Supreme Court, Norman Krivosha, who wrote in support of the lawsuit. With that brief background, let me introduce Steve Wilborn, who will speak first. I should mention that the intent here is not so much to debate the legal merits of the case as it is to clarify some of the many issues surrounding this complex lawsuit, legal and otherwise. And I would remind you again about forwarding your questions up to me. With that, let me introduce Steve Wilborn.
Thank you very much. I'd like to begin by saying how I came to this topic, because I came to it in the best of academic traditions. About a decade ago, a colleague of mine, Ramona Petzold from Texas A&M, and I were writing a book on how statistics are used in discrimination cases, and we decided to have a chapter in that book on how statistics are used in cases involving education. And in that chapter, we had two subsections, one on desegregation cases and one on school finance cases. I was assigned to write that, and I read all of the school finance cases out at that time in the best of academic ways, without any preconceptions, with a cool, hard, but critical look at the cases. And so that's how I came to know about this, and then these cases arise, and lo and behold, I know something about it. I also plan to kind of follow that academic tradition today and present to you not an advocacy piece for or against this case, but really a few comments to try to help you understand what the issues are, some of the roadblocks to winning the case, and some of the possibilities for winning the case. Having said that, I just want to make a couple caveats and reservations. One is that I know about these school finance lawsuits, but I have very limited knowledge about other aspects of Nebraska schools and certainly very limited knowledge about school financing formulas and all of that. So please don't ask me about that sort of thing. And as Hugh mentioned, I do have an opinion about these cases. And just so you can filter what I say through, as Hugh mentioned, I think they are not the strongest cases legally, and I don't think it's good public policy to pursue this way. But as I said, I'm going to try to do this as a relatively neutral disposition of the issues in the case. Now, I've entitled my suit sort of grandly, I suppose, the most important lawsuit in Nebraska history. To give you some context about why I think that, you may know that there is a $151 million judgment outstanding against the state of Nebraska out of issues arising from the low-level radioactive waste disposal site. That's a big judgment. About a year ago, the plaintiffs in this suit and others commissioned a study to decide how much extra money was needed to run our schools. And the result of that study was that $750 million was required. Now, they don't request that amount in this lawsuit, but that's a sense of what they think is needed to fund the schools adequately. Note, it's $151 million once for the low-level radioactive waste disposal site. This is $750 million every year forever. It's a very significant suit financially. Another reason it's important, of course, is because it involves our schools and our kids. It involves the future of Nebraska. So it's a very important suit. Very briefly, and for those of you in the room, I have a handout so you can follow along. As Mr. Cowden mentioned, the lawsuit was filed on June 30th, 2003 in the Douglas District Court of Douglas County. The defendants have filed a motion to dismiss this suit and to change the venue to Lancaster County. The plaintiffs had filed a responsive brief to that. The defendants have another chance to brief this. There's a hearing on that motion in January of next year. The Lincoln Schools is seeking to intervene on the side of the state in this case. There are three possible paths for this lawsuit. First, it can be dismissed at the district court. It will be appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court could dismiss it. If that's the route for this case, the case would be over at that point, and it could be done in 2004. A second possible route is that this would be that there would be a trial at the district court level, which would be a very complex and fairly lengthy trial, I would expect, and then the district court or the Supreme Court might dismiss it after a trial, and that would be the end of the suit. Probably take a bit longer because they'd have a trial in between. That would be fairly lengthy, but it could be in that case the case could be over fairly soon too, maybe late 2004, early 2005. The third possible path is that there is a trial, and the trial court finds that the system for financing schools is unconstitutional, and that the Nebraska Supreme Court upholds that. If that occurs, then we're in for a period of time where we try to sort out what a constitutional system would be like. The ball would be in the legislature's court to enact a new system, which might then also be challenged constitutionally, and I'll talk some about what's happened in other states in that situation. So that's the three possible paths. There is another suit likely to be filed soon. This group has said it is going to file another suit challenging the constitutionality of the school financing system soon. The group is called the Nebraska Coalition for Educational Equity and Adequacy. They've hired lawyers, both a very well-known national lawyer and a local lawyer. It is a group primarily that would represent smallish rural districts, but filing the same type of constitutional claim. I should say that the attorneys on all sides of this suit, representing the state, representing the school board, representing the Nebraska Coalition, are wonderful attorneys. It'll be a very well-tried lawsuit. And I say that not only because people from the firm are in the room, but because it's true as well. So on to the claims in the suit. There are two basic claims. One is called the adequacy claims. There's a provision in the Nebraska Constitution, as there is in most state constitutions, that requires the state to provide, and I quote now from the Nebraska Constitution, free instruction in the common schools. And so one part of this claim is that the state is not providing free instruction in the common schools in violation of that constitutional provision. The other basic claim is an equal protection claim. The Nebraska Constitution has a provision, an equal protection clause, and the claim is school children are treated too differently by our school financing system, and that's a violation of the equal protection clause. So let me talk about each of these. First, the free instruction claim. Once again, the provision is the Nebraska legislature has to provide free instruction in the common schools. First, I'm going to list some problems with this claim that will have to be overcome for the suit to be successful, and then I'll talk about a possible route for success. Problems with the claim. First problem is that our constitutional language is very weak. Most state constitutions have provisions in them that require education at the K-12 level. As you might imagine, that language ranges across a range of strength from very weak to very strong. Ours is on the very weak side of the continuum. I have some examples just to give you an idea of stronger language. The New Jersey Constitution requires the legislature to provide a thorough and efficient system of public schools. Note, ours is free instruction in the public schools. It's weaker. Theirs is thorough and efficient. This thorough and efficient language is in a very common in state constitutions. A number of state constitutions have it. We don't. Kansas's constitution, there's a major school finance suit going on there right now, requires the legislature, and it just fleshes it out a bit more. It says it requires them to provide for intellectual, educational, vocational, and scientific improvement by establishing free public schools. A little bit more meat to it. And then there are some almost comically verbose. Massachusetts has a long paragraph in the handout. I have only part of it, but they go on and on about what the schools have to do. Wisdom and knowledge being necessary for the preservation of rights and liberties. The Commonwealth must cherish the interests of literature and sciences and provide public schools. It's much more detailed, stronger language. So that's the first problem with the claim. Our language is weak, and that weak language will have to be overcome for the plaintiffs to be successful in this suit. Another problem with the suit is Initiative 411, which many of you would recall. In 1996, a constitutional amendment was proposed which would have put very strong language into our Constitution having to do with education. That amendment was to provide that quality education, not free instruction, shall be a fundamental constitutional right. Schools have to be thorough and efficient, and that education shall be the paramount duty of the state. That would have been very strong constitutional language. It would have placed our language on the other end of this continuum that I talk about. The voters rejected that amendment overwhelmingly. Now, I have a theory about why they rejected it, and my theory is that the amendment said that education shall be the paramount duty of the state, and we do have this football team, which we know of as the real paramount duty, but that may not be true. At any rate, it was rejected by about a 3-to-1 margin. There are technical reasons why that rejection, technical legal reasons why that shouldn't have any impact on this lawsuit, but it's a practical matter. I think it might affect judges as they review the case. Finally, a third possible problem with this claim is the role of the courts and the problems courts have had in constructing remedies once systems of school finance have been declared unconstitutional. If a court found Nebraska's system for financing education to be unconstitutional, it would have to decide what the remedy should be. This has proven to be very difficult. In New Jersey, I call it 8 Robinsons plus 7 Abbotts equal 20 years. What that means is that in New Jersey, 20 years ago when this suit was filed, it was called Robinson, and it reached the Supreme Court 8 different times under that name. There's Robinson 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 8. Then, for some reason that I haven't investigated, the name of the case changed to Abbott. Still the same school finance issue went up to the New Jersey Supreme Court 7 times, Abbott 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, and that was over a 20-year period. What was happening was the Supreme Court would declare the system unconstitutional, back to the legislature to enact another system. That one would be challenged back to the Supreme Court, still unconstitutional, and back and forth. Very hard to remedy this. Texas, I call it Rodriguez plus four Edgewoods equal West Orange Cove. I'm going to talk about Rodriguez. Rodriguez was a federal claim, school finance claim, rejected. No more federal claims after that. Then they started a state-based claim, which resulted in four Supreme Court decisions, Edgewood 1, 2, 3, 4, the same process. Now, very recently this summer, there was a case filed by the West Orange Cove School District, which is a claim by rich districts saying that it's unconstitutional. And their claim is the school finance system requires all rich districts to tax at the very top of the property tax limit. In Texas, that's a violation of the state constitutional provision against statewide property taxes. And so we don't know what will happen with that. The point here is that it's very difficult to remedy these. This is a problem. A number of states, three, four, five states, have said, state courts have said, we're not going to get involved in this kind of lawsuit because it's just too hard to remedy, even if we find a violation. It's one of the reasons the state is claiming the case should be dismissed. We'll find out what the Nebraska court thinks about that soon. Now, possible traction for the claim. This is not the first school finance case in Nebraska. There was an earlier case about 10 years ago called Gould versus Orr. The Nebraska Supreme Court, a completely different court, had completely different personnel, rejected that and said there was not a claim. But in rejecting it, they said there was no claim in this suit there was only a claim in this suit that there was a disparity in funding. There was no claim in it that the disparity in funding resulted in inadequate schooling. Case dismissed. Now, I want to compare that to a very recent case from New York State called the Campaign for Fiscal Equity versus State of New York. New York also has very weak constitutional language. The legislature shall provide for the maintenance and support of a system of free common schools. Similar to our language, weak. 10 years ago, they had a school finance suit that the Supreme Court rejected. In rejecting it, the New York Supreme Court, it's actually called the Court of Appeals, but the highest court in the state of New York, said, well, there's no claim here, but we do interpret the Education Clause to require a sound basic education. Kind of similar to our Gould versus Orr, which says maybe an adequate education would be a violation. Need an adequate education. Then, just this summer, the highest court in New York, took that fleshing out of the bare constitutional language to find that the system for financing schools in New York City was unconstitutional. So there is a path here, and it's a path that's provided by New York State. Weak constitutional language, fleshed out a bit a while ago in a case that's been rejected, then a finding of a constitutional violation. So that's possible. Am I getting close to the time? You. Let me go quickly through the other claim, the equality claim. There's an equal protection claim. No person shall be denied equal protection of the laws. A couple of problems with this is this is exactly the same as the Federal Equal Protection Clause, which has been interpreted not to permit this kind of lawsuit, and there have been no successful claims, as far as I'm aware, under the Federal Equal Protection Clause. And then there are problems with how we should interpret our own. There is possible traction for this claim as well. I call it 1 plus 1 equals 3, and I don't say that in a disparaging sense, but rather in the sense that the sum can be greater than the parts. An educational clause alone might lead to no successful lawsuit. An equal protection claim alone might lead to no lawsuit, as in the Rodriguez case. But with an education clause and an equal protection clause, which we have in our Constitution, but which is not in the federal constitution, perhaps there can be a claim. Just a very few quick comments at the end. Many people are interested in what effect this will have on funding for schools. What effect does school finance suit have on funding for schools, and what effect does it have on centralization of schools? The best study I know of by Michael Heise in the Georgia Law Review in 1998 is an empirical study, finds kind of interestingly that there is no effect of school finance cases, almost no effect, on funding levels. Schools who win school finance suits does not result in greater funding. Now, at first you might think that's kind of curious, but the reason for that, I think, if you think of a state like Nebraska, which has not had a successful school finance suit, has had great increases in its state funding, nonetheless. So you have to ask if a school finance suit will add to that funding, and through his empirical study, he says he doesn't think so. And just a resource now for tracking school finance law litigation, there's a wonderful website. It's www.accessednetwork.org/statesmaine.html. It's a map of the United States. You click on any state, and it'll tell you if there's been a school finance suit in that state. It'll tell you what the result is. Just as you should take everything I say with a grain of salt because I'm somewhat opposed to this lawsuit, they are very much in favor of school finance lawsuits. So look at it. It's a great resource. They twist things to favor these lawsuits, and that's fine. So I went over my time a little bit. I'm sorry, Hugh, but thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Now let me introduce John Langan, president of the Omaha School Board. He has a raspy voice.
Yes, unfortunately, you get me raspy voice and all, but thanks you and thanks to the press club and to those of you in attendance for giving me the opportunity to speak on what I believe is the most critical issue in the state of Nebraska and in any other state for that matter, and that is public education. I'll leave the legal aspects of this situation to the courts and judges and lawyers, but I feel prompted to make one quote from someone Hugh already alluded to. But Norman Krivosha, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in commenting on OPS's position, said this: "I feel compelled to comment regarding the question that the courts are not the proper forum for which to determine Nebraska's constitutional meaning. I do so because nothing could be farther from the truth, and most important, it is harmful to our form of government and the notion of separation of powers to attempt to convince the lay public that the court is an inappropriate forum for which to question the meaning of the Constitution. Should we ever believe that false notion, our government would be in serious trouble. I'm here to talk to you about several things. First, OPS demographics. Second, financial facts about the Omaha Public Schools and surrounding schools. Third, the Nebraska funding formula. Fourth, and most important, kids and learning. And finally, and you'll have to wait, and you may cut me off so I might not get to it, but I'd like to tell you the tale of two cities. First of all, OPS, 45,000 youngsters, the only urban school district in the state where the funding formula used by the state is supposed to provide adequate and equitable education for these kids. And I suggest to you that the formula is broken and it needs to be fixed. Demographics, OPS is 31% African American, 18.1% Hispanic, 1.7% Asian, 1.5% Native American, and 46.6% Caucasian. We have 55.2% of the kids on free and reduced lunch, which is the use the federal government makes to benchmark poverty. We have 6,000 students who speak English as a second language, so 6,000 limited language learners in this district. And understand that many of these youngsters come to our district, to the Omaha Public Schools, at age 14, 15, and 16, and are illiterate in their native tongue. So now we have to do assessments and look at these youngsters who are illiterate in their native tongue. First we teach them English, and then we teach them to come up to speed at a 7th grade, 8th grade level. And finally, in terms of the demographics of the youngsters, in terms of a picture for you, we have a significant number of our students who are categorized as fragile youngsters with special needs. And given the availability of two major higher education research hospitals, that's an inordinate percentage. We get an inordinate percentage of these youngsters who are waiting for kidney transplants, for all types of dialysis, et cetera. Those youngsters attend the Omaha Public Schools. And at any given time, in any given year in this district, we have over 300 youngsters who are homeless. That's background. Financial facts. Given the demographics just presented, what would one infer about the per pupil expenditure on a continuum of the 550 districts in the state of Nebraska? That we would be the lowest per pupil, that we'd be the middle, or that we would be at the top end? I suggest to you it would be somewhere beyond the middle of the average per pupil expenditure, where indeed we are $350 below the median per pupil expenditure of the 550 school districts in the state of Nebraska. And just a quick math, if you take that times our 45,000 youngsters, Omaha Public would enjoy $16 million more per year in their budget if we just got the average per pupil expenditure in the state. Fact. Given the odds or the flip of the coin on birth for an Omaha City of Omaha youngster, if she or he is born east of 72nd versus west of 72nd. If you're east, you get $1,000 plus less per year spent on you than if you born west of 72nd Street. There's something wrong with our formula, folks. Nebraska ranks 50th among the states in the percentage of dollars allocated for elementary and secondary schools by the state. We rank 50th. In a letter to the state commissioners, former Secretary of Education Riley said this, that urban schools are being shortchanged horrendously and that they are underfunded. In doing so, he looked at the 100 largest urban city school districts and just determined how underfunded they were. The Omaha Public Schools ranked 10th among the most underfunded urban school districts in the United States. Insult to injury, let me tell you that 40% of all state revenue that goes towards public schools comes from, yes, right here in River City. And I suggest to you, 40% does not come back to Omaha. The funding formula. Just as I suggested leaving the courts to the judge, the legal issues to the judges and the courts, I'd ordinarily leave the funding formula to Dennis Poole. And let me suggest to you that our financial officer knows more about school funding in the state of Nebraska than anyone else in the state of Nebraska, and I'll stand tall on that comment. But I will tell you that he spends an inordinate amount of time getting yours truly and the other 11 board members up to snuff on the funding formula. So while we understand it, as Dr. Wilbaum said, don't ask him questions, don't ask me intricate questions about the formula. But what the current formula does, ladies and gentlemen, is it looks backward. It looks back and says, okay, OPS, Lincoln, Ralston, Papillion, Ogallala, Upper Overshoe, how much did you spend on education in the last X number of years? And then it distributes the money based on that spending. So it's a backward-looking formula, not looking at what are you being asked to do, not looking at the demographics of every district that they look backward to and then look forward. They simply look back and say, okay, how much does it take? In addition to looking backwards, they also penalize, in my not-so-humble opinion, institutions who try to stay within the levy limits and the lids by not doing overrides, by not exceeding the limit, by saying, well, listen, you chose not to exceed the limit, so we're going to reduce your spending, versus the districts that went willy-nilly and exceeded the limit through a vote of the board. They got more money. So 2020 hindsight, we were told by a fellow board member in the press, you should have spent that money when you had it. We were being fiscally responsible, and the legislature sought to penalize those districts who were fiscally responsible. Why the lawsuit not working with the legislature? Let me tell you unequivocally, there is not a board member on our board who wanted to file a lawsuit. But we saw no other alternative. And our hope of hopes is that the lawsuit will prompt the governor, the legislature, and in particular Senator Raikes, and the State Board of Education to look at what we're trying to say. Now, you might say, well, why didn't you do that before you did the lawsuit? Let me tell you that for 3.5 years, people ask me, how much time do you spend on this board, Langen? And I'm fairly conservative. But for the last 3.5 years, my car can go to Lincoln and come back by itself because we've been there. We've talked. Our administrators have been there. Let me give you some specifics. Dennis Poole was appointed to chair a committee of the legislature to review school finance. Keep in mind who I said knew more about school finance than anyone in the state. They made recommendations, and what happened is those recommendations were summarily rejected and the committee disbanded. I would say that's not cooperation from the legislature. We sent parents, we sent teachers, we sent community members on buses to the legislature. And yours truly spoke to a study I'm going to talk about next that Dean Wilbaum referred to, the Ogden, Blick, and Meyer study, but when I talked about that study, and certainly that number is big, and I'll talk a bit about that, Senator Raikes said to me, John, I think that's like having the fox watch the chicken coop. I would suggest to you that if I wanted to look at medical schools, or I wanted to look at law schools, or if I wanted to look at business, I would not ask educators to do it. I'd ask the people from that profession to look at it, because what the Ogden, Blick, and Meyer study was, folks, is a study by the House of Education, not by the Omaha Public Schools, not by John Langen, of teachers teachers who were in the trenches teaching these youngsters I've just identified, teaching special needs youngsters, teaching homeless youngsters, teaching English language learners, and saying, what does it take to do that? From that, they used a panel of experts to determine costs, et cetera. And I might back up a minute and say, the state legislature in this state used Ogden, Blick, and Meyer in an earlier study to look at funding of schools in our own state. And what Ogden, Blick, and Meyer did was they came up through a process of panels of experts with a number. We never suggested to the legislature or to the governor or to anyone else that we thought the $700 million or whatever was the answer. What we said was, that shows you, in comparison what you are spending and the fact that you are 50th in the nation, you might consider changing the formula. The formula is not working. It's broken, and it needs to be fixed. And so I'm telling you, folks, the ideology politically of that 12-person board is A to Z, and I'm over here, and probably more than not are over here. But there was no doubt when we made that vote, it was a 12-0 vote to file the lawsuit because of the issues I've said and because we tried to do what we tried to do. Let me talk about my favorite subject, the kids. And this is what I really want to talk to you about. But our district and our state, and yes, even our local newspaper, recognizes the problem that's the essence of our lawsuit, and that is adequacy and equity. And they recognize it in this context. We like to say, you know, we've got the highest test. We're fourth in the nation. We're here. We're here. But when you disaggregate data, folks, when you take out specific populations like special needs youngsters, like English language learners, like disadvantaged youngsters, we look like most other places, horrid. And for school districts to say, I'm not willing to admit we're failing specific populations, we don't say that in the sense that we have teachers who can't do things. We know what to do. And I'm going to tell you some give you some examples of what the Omaha Public Schools have done on their own or with private monies or with grants or with external dollars, not from the state of Nebraska. And we've done such things as this. Let me catch myself here. Getting rambling, getting caught up in. We have probably the most wonderful state-of-the-art early childhood facility in the United States, funded by private donations, operated by private donations. We have Winner's Circle, funded by a private businessman, and continued, not just a year and a splash in the pan, thanks, here's my company. In fact, he doesn't even own the company anymore, and he still spends more time in our schools than some of us do. But again, by private monies. A teen literacy center, funded by private monies. A dual language program, funded by external funds. Magnet schools, funded on the backs of the other kids in terms of this district having to make judgments about what we do and what we can do and what we can't do. And finally, a teacher ratio reduction in our academy schools, saying that no youngster in the academy schools, keep in mind, that's where the preponderance of our disadvantaged youngsters are. It's where the preponderance of our English language learners are. We said we're taking the ratio from 20 to 25 down to 15 in the primary grades and down to 20 in the intermediate grades. The state didn't come forward and say, nice job, here's some more money for doing that. They said, way to go, you can do that, see? And what we lack as a result of having to make those decisions, you come to our district, you don't get all-day kindergarten in every school. We know that time on task helps youngsters learn. You don't have early childhood programs in every school. We know that early childhood programs work. A private donor has given us a state-of-the-art facility, but that addresses 200 youngsters. Remember what I told you? 55% of our youngsters are in that category. So the issue of addressing these things, we know how to do it. We have wonderful teachers and administrators who can implement that, but we don't have the dollars, folks, to do it. And when you try to shift dollars through reduction in class sizes, what you get is a natural reaction to schools who are not academy schools. So I'm teaching, I'm an elementary teacher by training. So I'm over here in a non-academy school with 25 youngsters. I'll say, hey, wait, why do they have 15? I understand that difference. But that difference is the same naivete that lets citizens of this state and many other states say, there's nothing wrong with public education. Those kids just don't want to learn. So let me talk about those kids. Let me talk about those special ed kids. Let me talk about the disadvantaged kids. Let me talk about the English language learners and the kid who happened to be born on the east side of 72nd Street. They didn't choose any of those categories. They came here, like you and like many of you. We were all lucky, I would say, in this room. They weren't as lucky. But they have the same desire to learn. They have the same ability to learn. But they come with a deficit. Sometimes they're hungry. Sometimes they're sick. Sometimes they're both. Sometimes there are no parents in the home. There's all kinds of variables. And that takes catching up. And the state doesn't say, oh, yeah, John, we'll catch you up. We'll do that. We'll do this. Let me talk about what the proposed revised education bill did in the legislature. And we had two of them. We proposed 775, which was an outgrowth of Augenblick and Meyer, saying, look at what you're asking us to do. What are the standards, national standards, and I could go on and on about those, but we won't. Local standards, state standards. What does it take to deliver that for all youngsters, not just for the kids who could have gone on and succeeded without our schools? And we take credit for that, and we should admit that, too. You guys get the credit for most of that. I take your kids in a private school. I don't need any money from anyone. Because they come with the tools. They come nurtured. They get nurtured. They get the type of things that these kids don't get. But the inference always is, well, I learn English. Why can't they learn English? The English is, well, the kids come dirty. They don't care. They cut up in class. Those kids have the same needs, the same wants, and their parents love them as much as we love our kids. What they don't know is what to do to nurture the things that those kids need to succeed. And what I'm asking, what the lawsuit is asking is, look at categories of youngsters. Look at special needs youngsters. Look at English language learners. Look at kids from low socioeconomic conditions. And let's build a formula that helps. Instead, what we got at, in terms of a look-see at the legislative bill and going to the legislature was a tweak, as Senator Rake said. We can tweak the formula and make it work. Well, the tweaking he did was to reduce the need side of the formula. We have a formula that says like 1.2 is the weighting formula for a special needs youngster. We know from Augenblick and Meyer, from talking to teachers, from looking nationally, and from going into our schools, and that's all I ask you to do, go in and look. It takes a lot more than 0.2. That most of the ratios that we looked at that exist in the state formula before they reduced them were about half of what we need. And instead of looking at that and going forward, the legislature, in an infinite wisdom in a revision, reduced the needs formula. Why? To balance the budget. That's why they did it. So our kids lost. Let me conclude in the context of the kids, saying that another thing that this district did was a result of the school funding formula. We had to cut, because of LIDS over the last 7 years, money out of the general operating budget. So we went to the capital fund, the money that's in the bill, in the budget for repair, for buildings, for providing schools. And what we knew was, again, look at the kids, the building that we needed to be done was mostly east of 72nd Street. And what we did was put on the backs of the voters who live in the Omaha Public School District a $254 million bond issue. And we said, that's half of our needs. That's just half of them. But what we need to do is bring these schools up to snuff, because we know also that will keep and retain youngsters. So we did that. These are all issues that, again, the frustration from a person who's in the governance side of the school district says, we're doing them. We're doing them in lieu of state dollars, and we're tired of doing them in lieu of state dollars. And we know some facts about the issues. And the last piece in terms of the lawsuit, people say, well, why did you do the lawsuit? Number one, to get more money. Number two, to get people to pay attention. And number three, let me give you an example in River City, and the fellow in the audience who read this at the Economic Outlook Conference of the Chamber of Commerce did it, but the number three issue among businessmen, not among educators, was the restructure of funding for K-12 and higher education. Restructure it is what they said. Now, albeit they have 775 on there, I'm not going there, or I'm not going to talk about 775. But anyhow. The last piece before I give you two more quotes and sit down. The Tale of Two Cities. Let me just tell you, and you might say this doesn't fit the lawsuit. Maybe it doesn't, but I think it does. The Omaha Public Schools sits in a city with seven school districts, seven public school districts. And if this were the Omaha city boundaries, that table would be one of the districts. So we surround it. And so what you get is this. Let's look at City Lincoln, City Omaha. City Lincoln, one school district. So what do you have with regard to per pupil expenditure? One. So they're not competing. That kid doesn't determine whether he's born on 5th Street or 9th Street or West Lincoln or East Lincoln. He's okay. She's okay. Per pupil expenditure is the same. Omaha, different. Text selection, just a single item. We buy text, and the 6 other districts buy text. There's economy in there. I'm not an economics major, but I know there's economy in there that we need to look at. Curricular decisions. Lincoln makes a decision. Boom, it's done. Omaha Public Schools makes a decision. And we hear, well, I don't do that, and you fill in the suburban district. They don't do that here. You don't, why don't you have this? Why don't you have that? Why don't you have this? Teacher recruitment. When I came to Nebraska too many years ago, there was just a gentleman's agreement. You did not raid teachers and administrators from other districts. Not only does that happen now, they call them at school and say, listen, come on over here. Here's what we'll give you. That's a difference, folks, and it's a difference in terms of quality staff to deal with all kids, quality administrators to deal with buildings and kids. And those are issues that you have to deal with when you're talking about school finance. Now think of this comparison of the Tale of Two Cities in the context of another piece of wonderful legislation in the state called school choice. So now you're the parents of a bubbling 5-year-old that's getting ready to go to school, and you go to look at your options in Lincoln, where do you go? And make a difference. You might be arguing school to school, but you go to Lincoln Public Schools. You get one per pupil expenditure. Now you're sitting here in Omaha and you say, hey, I know I'm on the wrong side of 72nd Street, but I have the means and the understanding and to say if I go west of 72nd Street, I get $1,000 more per year spent on my youngster. So then they say, well, we have quality schools is better because we draw. You have it because you don't want our kids in your school district. That's why you have the differences in there, and that's why you pass override. So don't point your finger at the only urban district because it'll come back to bite you, and I'll stop right here. It'll bite you in this sense. We'll start looking like, and keep in mind the geography as I talk about this, we'll start looking like New York City and Los Angeles and Houston and now Denver and now Kansas City. Those urban school districts are dying, folks. And when they die, it hurts developments like the one we can see out this window and the ones that are proposed to go up outside this window. And I suggest to you, our Board of Education, our administration, doesn't want that to happen. I'm going to close with two quotes. One from the territorial governor of the state of Nebraska, who said in 1864, and I repeat, politically, educating our children is the only right choice. The future character of a people of Nebraska depends more on the attention paid by her legislature from year to year to the subject of the common schools than to all other causes combined, highways included. He didn't say that. The history of the world proves that educated and virtuous people can never be enslaved, and the hearts and masses no people become greater and powerful without education. I'll sit down now with one of my favorite people. Alexis de Tocqueville said, and I quote, and I'm stealing this from something that the Supreme Court justice said, but I love it. But de Tocqueville wrote Democracy in America, and in that, he was from France, spent time in the United States. He said, and think of how appropriate it is right now. In France, he said, if you were born to a certain station in life, you could never hope to rise higher than that station. And in America, it doesn't matter who your parents are. With free education, you may become what you want. And some kids don't have parents, and some kids don't have parents who understand what it is that de Tocqueville said, but I hope the rest of us do. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Your voice sort of held up there. I want to pull rank and ask the first question. Both of you seem to agree that there are real problems and that the funding formula is broken. The John went to the, and the school board went to the courts. Steve feels that that's not the right route. I would like to ask Dean Wilburn, what would you advise the Omaha School Board to do if they don't go to the courts in order to fix those problems?
Well, thank you. It's part of what I had prepared to say. I didn't have time to say, so I appreciate the question. Let me start by, I think the appropriate route is to go through the legislature, and I know it's been frustrating for the school board to do that. The reason that it's advisable to go through the legislature, though, is that a structural problem with the courts is that they can consider only the parties before them. They can consider the school district, and they can consider other schools as all. This is not a problem that's restricted to schools. If the school district gets $750 million more a year, it has to come from somewhere. It has to come from health care for poor children. It has to come from highways. It has to come from the university. It has to come from the taxpayers. The reason that in other states these cases take 20 years is that the courts are focused on schools. It goes to the legislature, which begins a much more complex process of balancing priorities between all of these things, and it's very difficult to resolve. The legislature is set up to consider these kinds of very important and conflicting priorities and to make a resolution. Most people are frustrated by what the legislature does. The school board is, the university is, highways less so, but once in a while they're frustrated. I think the appropriate forum is the legislature.
Do you have a response to that, John?
No, only that the legislature had a problem last year of $500 million, and they solved it because they had to solve it. They have a problem now, and that is adequate and equitable education, and they need to solve it.
Is the lawsuit too complicated to generate much public interest? Either one of you?
Well, the only thing I would say is my good friends in the Chamber of Commerce said no. They think it's now the third highest issue on their batting order. That wasn't true a year ago. The governor's saying he's hoping he can resolve. He's been to the Omaha Public Schools more in the last several months than he's been during my other remainder of my tenure on the board.
I agree with Mr. Langan. I don't know the answer to the question, but I hope it's not too complex for the public to be involved and interested, because it's one of the most important issues our state faces. So I hope they become involved and interested enough to express their views.
Dean Wilburn, in your view, which route will the lawsuit take? You mentioned three possibilities.
Well, I think it is a weak suit legally. I think it's winnable. And New York provides the recent New York experience provides a pathway to winning. But Mr. Langan pointed out some reasons that it's not exactly like New York. The worst schools in New York, thankfully, are much worse than the worst schools in Nebraska. The best schools in New York are better. I mean, they have schools with many Nobel laureates who graduated from them, so that the disparities in New York were greater than ours. Supreme Court will decide this. We don't know the views of any member of the Supreme Court on this, but it will be a tough row to hoe to win. Could be one, but a tough row to hoe.
How much will the lawsuit cost? Do either of you?
I don't know. I don't care. And I don't say that flippantly, because what I say is, let's say it costs $50 million. If we were to get the average state per pupil expenditure, we'd get $16 million a year for the next on infinitum years. That would pay for the lawsuit in 2 seconds. Instead, we sit, and not only are we $350 below, 6 years ago we were 69 cents below. So look how the curve is going, folks. We got to stop the curve going down.
It would be very expensive. I'm a dean of a law school. I like demand for legal services going up, so that's good by my lights. No, it'll be expensive. The school board, I understand, has a substantial fund of money from private sources to fund their expenses. The state has hired a very good law firm in Omaha to represent them. That will be costly, and I assume the Lincoln School Board will be paying their own fees there as well.
How do the recent federal educational requirements affect this lawsuit? That is, our state language regarding education is weak, but new national standards are quite clear.
Can we not use pressure from Washington, D.C. to further support this lawsuit?
I've never thought of that. Politically, ideologically, I would take off for about two more hours on the No Child Left Behind legislation. But in effect, if Secretary of Education Page were wise, he would be jumping on the OPS bandwagon, because what we're saying is these standards have been set at the national level, they've been set at the state level, they've been set at the local level. But without funding to help meet the standards, what do? You cut X, Y, Z until you get down to bones, and we're at the bone.
I agree with Mr. Lang. I don't know how successful it will be, but one part of the claim by plaintiffs is that they are required to meet these standards, as well as a number of other standards, but the federal standards in particular, and they don't have adequate resources to do it, and it's a part of their claim. The strength of that claim, I don't know.
Should the Omaha districts be merged? John?
Our lawsuit is not about merger and merging school districts. If we merged all 550-plus school districts, the financial dilemma that education, public education, is in the state of Nebraska would not be solved.
But this question refers to the Omaha, the districts in the Omaha area.
If you merged all the districts in the Omaha area, the lawsuit still stands. The problem still exists. The kids are still there. And an awareness of the significant population of youngsters we're talking about is an issue of this district, not of merger, and I know merger comes up all the time. And I don't want to bore you with the details of some things we've done, but we have interlocal agreements. There are things going on in the metro area. We're not at loggerheads with the other districts in the Omaha area, but when it comes to the school finance formula funding, we talk about it in that context, and we've agreed to disagree on some issues.
Just another part of my speech that I didn't get to mention, another part of the Heiss empirical study of school finance suits did involve the effect of these lawsuits on centralization, on consolidation of school districts. And he found, as he kind of surprisingly to me, was the finding with funding, that the lawsuits have no effect on centralization. And once again, I think the way to think about that is to think about centralization that's already occurred in Nebraska. The number of school districts has gone down to still quite a few, but down a lot. Without a school finance suit. And so the question is whether these suits accelerate that process. And his finding empirically is that they do not. So in a sense, there's separate questions.
Hugh, if I can, with no disrespect, it's gone down, but we have 550 school districts in a state of 1.7 million people.
Let me ask John specifically. OPS has said that they would be willing to meet with state officials to settle the case out of court. What are the chances of this?
The Education Trust, who has met with the governor, has willingly, openly said, we will talk to anyone who will talk to us. So again, as I indicated in my presentation, our objective is to correct the school funding formula. The court of last resort, with no pun intended, was a lawsuit. We didn't go into this starting out with a lawsuit. We started out talking to legislators, talking to the governor, and talking to anyone who would listen to us. And so yes, I think that's not a false promise. Our superintendent and the districts in the trust are willing to talk to people and have been.
Hugh, regardless of what happens with this lawsuit, it will be settled in the legislature some way. I mean, if they win the lawsuit, the only thing they're claiming is that the current system be declared unconstitutional. And when that happens, it would go back to the legislature. So I think it will go back there. The legislature is in something of a box because there is this other lawsuit by a completely different set of schools with a completely different set of interests. And it's a complicated negotiating process.
Steve, you mentioned the upcoming hearing in January, the state of Nebraska filing a motion to dismiss the lawsuit and to change the venue from Douglas County to Lancaster County. What chances do these motions have of succeeding?
I have no idea. My guess wouldn't be any better than yours, Hughes. What do you think?
Hi.
If they decide to change venue, If I were the judge, and I think Judge Lamberty will decide the venue question first. If she decides to change venue, then they'll reassign it to Lincoln, and the Lincoln court would then decide the motion to dismiss. So there may be a delay before we get to that. If she decides not to change venue and to decide it herself, then she may well be prepared to decide herself whether to dismiss fairly promptly after that.
Why is Lincoln opposed, and will they lose funding? John?
Good question. I think that one has to look at districts and look at financial structure and look at demographics and look at scenarios and ask yourself the question. I have some inferences as to why, but I don't know why.
The Omaha World Herald wrote in an editorial that, quote, "this lawsuit means the death of the status quo," unquote. That implies that no matter how this case turns out, there will be fundamental changes in Nebraska's education system. Do you agree that inevitably it will lead to fundamental changes?
I hope at least a fundamental change, and I have strong hope that it will, and I indicated in my presentation again that that was the motivator. Our governmental system, and that is a little bit of background, but it has three branches of government, and I think what the school board said was, we can't get it with the other two, we're going to the third one.
The school financing is a very dynamic situation. There'll be changes. How dramatic, I don't know. Let me just go to the ivory tower for a second. It's a part of my talk that I didn't give, but one of my concerns about society involves this suit as a minor example, but there are more major examples. Congress is poised to pass a $400 billion drug benefit. They passed a $70-plus billion bill recently for Iraq. We expect much from government, and it's very expensive to provide what government wants. An interesting aspect of both of those is that there's no indication whatsoever about how they're going to be paid for. There are no tax increases. There's no repeal of tax reductions to pay for them. This lawsuit, in a sense, fits into that pattern where we expect a lot and justly expect a lot from our school system. What we're reluctant to do is to talk about raising taxes to do it. I wish we would. I read a book, and I'd recommend it to you, by Steve Weissman called The Great Tax Wars, about tax policy between the Civil War and Second World War, and it says bad things about me that I read that for pleasure. But an arresting thing about this that was not his point was that when we entered the Civil War, we knew it was going to be costly. We implemented an income tax, and the society decided we had to pay for it. And when the Civil War ended, the taxes went away, and so be it. First World War, expensive income tax implemented. We decided to pay for it. A very troubling aspect of society these days, I think, and it doesn't really have to do with the lawsuit directly, is we agree to, we have high expectations and expensive expectations, and we pursue them, but we don't have the same societal sense that it's necessary for us now to pay for them.
Let me give one piece of data that will, I hope, come out as we talk about the lawsuit and funding of public education. It costs $7,000 plus or minus to educate a youngster in this school district of Omaha. It costs $29,000 to keep a prisoner in the Douglas County Jail. And let me give you one more fact. Of the prisoners in the Douglas County Jail, 95% plus do not have a high school diploma. So what kind of logic does it take to get from here to here? If we put the money on the front end and we educate these youngsters, all of the youngsters, and we keep them in school, we'll keep them out of the prison. So the dollar cost accounting of it will come out if you look at it. But instead, and I agree with Steve, what we talk about all the time is, oh, my pocketbook and my tax. And I happen to be on the A side of the A to Z, and I'm willing to pay the tax. And the issue is still not simply about that. I think the message has to get out is, pay me now or pay me later. If you want Omaha to look like Chicago, to look like Denver, to look like Los Angeles, to look like Kansas City in terms of an urban school district, go ahead and keep yelling about your taxes.
We're out of time. I want to thank John Langan and Steve Wilburn for taking the time to participate in this forum. Steve had to travel to get here. John had to bring his voice with him. And for helping us to understand this important case, and our thanks as well to our audience here at the Omaha Press Club for your questions and to our KIOS radio audience. I have two quick announcements. Beginning with this program today, we are making our Press Club noon forums available via the Internet under an agreement with CP Media. Videotape copies are also available. Anyone interested should contact CP Media at 1-800-227-5281 or call the Press Club. And secondly, there is no forum in December. Our next noon forum is Wednesday, January 21st. Nebraska Governor Mike Johanns and the Speaker of the Legislature, Senator Kurt Brahm, will be here for a joint appearance to talk about the state budget, one of the thorniest issues as the legislature begins another session in January. Again, that is Wednesday, January 21st. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's topic was the Omaha Public Schools versus the state of Nebraska. The speakers were Stephen Wilborn, the Dean of the University of Nebraska College of Law, and John Langan, the President of the Omaha Public Schools Board of Education. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, November 20th, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Hugh Cowden for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.